In a special liturgy in St. Peter's Basilica on the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul, Pope Benedict Tuesday bestowed the pallium on 38 metropolitan archbishops newly appointed over the past year. While the Feast of the Church's two founding apostles is a city-wide holiday here in Rome, Jill Bevilacqua explores the fascination travelers throughout the centuries have had with the Eternal City and its link with Peter and Paul. Let's listen.
If you are at Rome, live in the Roman style.
People out of Rome have no idea how one is schooled here.
Rome was tawdry and so crowded. I hated it.
One would say that the neighboring towns have all breathed the beneficial air of a gentle, pure wind blowing from the direction of Rome.
Plutarch, of course, the first century Greek biographer, was writing in metaphor about Rome in the time of Numa, the priest king, lover of peace. The influence of the gentle Sabine was such
that in men's hearts a desire for a quiet life has been born. To cultivate the land, to bring up their children in peace, to serve and honor the gods. Soon nothing else was seen but games, feasts, sacrifices, banquets. The people got to know each other. They mixed freely with one another without fear, without danger.
Numa Pompilius reigned 7 centuries before Christ, but it's quite likely that the climate of Rome was not so very different from that of today. The winds surely were the same then as now. H.V. Morton tells us about 2 of them.
The scirocco, blowing all day, had filled Rome with the hot, uneasy smell of Africa. Nerves were short, as they are during the Cape Southeaster, and men popping about on Vespers seemed fit targets for one's exasperation. The marble in the Forum was too hot to sit on. The restaurants were encircled by nauseating whiffs of ravioli, and the asphalt of the Corso had melted into soft treacle. During the siesta, I lay on my bed, watching the incandescent stripes as they palpitated against the slats of the shutters, dreading the moment when I would have to go out into the airless streets again. But when I did so, something marvelous had happened. A soft, gentle wind, the Ponentino, in which I fancied I could smell the sea, was blowing through Rome, and life was bearable again.
Life in Rome in the first century, however, seems to have been something less than bearable. The Spanish-born poet Martial complained of the noise, but then he did have a room with a broken window. But owners of blocks of flats were just as profiteering as those of today, being built at rock-bottom price and far from solid, wrote Martial's friend Juvenal, who came to Rome from Aquila.
We inhabit a town which is largely built of wooden beams, and when the landlord has stopped up the crack in an old wall, he invites the people to sleep in all quietness in the ruin hung above their head.
Juvenal, who lived in near poverty most of his life, declared that it was better to be the slave of a rich man than a poor citizen. Rents were high, and the poor occupied the upper stories. An attic might be reached only by ladder, and if the tenant failed to pay his rent, the owner simply withdrew the ladder. This was known as precludere inquilinem, or confining the tenant. Juvenal's satires were directed not only at the idle rich, but at the Roman populace, who were, he declared in a famous phrase, interested only in bread and circuses. Bread being the free corn dole, and circuses the variety of free spectacles offered by the emperors, chariot races, mock sea fights, gladiatorial flights, and the throwing of Christians to wild beasts. If he'd lived in the 4th century, Juvenal would have seen a different Rome, where Christian feast days were a cause for rejoicing. The Spanish poet Prudentius was in Rome on the feast of Saints Peter and Paul.
An extraordinary crowd, festive, rushing. Why, my friend, is it wandering throughout the city, filling it with clamour and jubilation? Here we are once again at the day of the Apostles' triumph. Watch the throngs of Romans in the city squares, some going one way, some another. There are really two feasts, but the joy is one.
From early times, the Feast of the Apostles was kept with great solemnity in Rome, and in the 4th century, it was almost like our Christmas Day festivities. But when St. Jerome wrote to his friend, the Virgin St. Eustochium, to acknowledge a gift of fruit and sweets, he reminded her that the feast should be celebrated rather with exaltation of spirit than with abundance of food. He was probably thinking of the banquets held under the porticos of St. Peter's, originally intended to relieve the poor, but which soon degenerated into excesses. What would Jerome have thought of the festivities of St. John's Day in the square and streets around St. John Lateran, as recorded by the Rome correspondent of the Tablet in 1901?
The day is associated in the mind of every Roman with stalls, roast pig, cloves, pinks, bells of baked clay and lavender. The cloves are blessed by a cardinal in a cloister of the basilica on the eve before Vespers, and a small packet of them is given to each member of the chapter. They're used in presses where woolen goods are stored to keep moths away. The lavender, which is not blessed, is used for the same purpose. The pinks serve for ornament, the clay bells amuse the children, and the roast pig is devoured by the proletariat. The feast goes on merrily at illuminated stalls all through the night, and the Romans flock there to witness the scene.
But here, too, the devil managed to spoil things. Writing in Pilgrim Walks in Rome, Jesuit Father Chandlery complained that, of late years, the popular enjoyment has been disturbed by roughs of the lowest type. Few respectable people care now to go and see the merriment. But probably no Roman occasion is more widely known today than the Pope's Urbi et Orbi blessing on Easter Sunday. Charles Dickens was enthusiastic, and the weather was kind.
On Easter Sunday, as well as on the preceding Thursday, the Pope bestows his benediction on the people from the balcony in front of St. Peter's. This Easter Sunday was a day so bright and blue, so cloudless, balmy, wonderfully bright, that all the previous bad weather vanished from the recollection in a minute. I had seen the Thursday's benediction dropping damply on some hundreds of umbrellas, but there was not a sparkle then in all the 100 fountains of Rome, such fountains as they are, and on this Sunday morning they were running diamonds. 150,000 people were there at least, yet there was ample room. How many carriages were there, I don't know, yet there was room for them too and to spare. The great steps of the church were densely crowded. Below the steps, the troops were ranged. In the magnificent proportions of the place, they looked like a bed of flowers, and the mingling of bright colours in the crowd was beautiful. Sulky Romans, lively peasants from the neighbouring country, groups of pilgrims from distant parts of Italy, sightseeing foreigners of all nations, made a murmur in the clear air, like so many insects, and high above them all, plashing and bubbling and making rainbow colours in the light, the two delicious fountains welled and tumbled bountifully.
Familiar though the scene is to many of us, it comes to life again in the freshness of the writer's first impression.
A kind of bright carpet was hung over the front of the balcony, and the sides of the great window were bedecked with crimson drapery. An awning was stretched too over the top to screen the old man from the hot rays of the sun. As noon approached, all eyes were turned up to this window. In due time, the chair was seen approaching to the front, with the gigantic fans of peacock's feathers close behind. the doll within it, for the balcony is very high, then rose up and stretched out its tiny arms, while all the male spectators in the crowd uncovered, and some, but not by any means the greater part, kneeled down. The guns upon the ramparts of the castle of St. Angelo proclaimed next moment that the benediction was given. Drums beat, trumpets sounded, arms clashed, and the great mass below, suddenly breaking into smaller heaps and scattering here and there in rills, was stirred like party-coloured sand.
The poet and novelist D.H. Lawrence, who travelled in Italy in the early decades of the century, was enchanted by the countryside, but abhorred Italian towns. Rome was no exception.
Rome was tawdry and so crowded. I hated it.
Lawrence, of course, didn't stay long enough to savour the atmosphere of Rome, which the city only offers to those who take time out to discover it. And the advice St. Ambrose gave to St. Augustine all those centuries ago surely still holds.
If you are at Rome, live in the Roman style. If you are elsewhere, live as they live elsewhere.
There are some, though, who, no matter how long they live here, continue to behave as if they were elsewhere. In a book called 6 Months in Italy, published in Boston in 1853, the American author George Stillman Hilliard described the Englishmen in Rome at that time.
In the morning, they may be seen in Monaldini's reading room, poring over the Times, galloping over the Campagna, driving about the streets and never looking to the right hand or the left, or gathering in groups in the Piazza di Spagna to hear the last news from home. In the afternoon, they betake themselves to the Pincio, and for a certain season pace up and down its graveled terrace with vigorous strides, their faces wearing a look of determined resolve, as if the constitution of their country, as well as their own, would suffer if they lost their daily walk.
Perhaps the German poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who arrived in Rome in 1786, summed it best when he said,
"Certainly, people out of Rome have no idea how one is schooled here. One has to be born again, so to speak, and one learns to look back upon one's old ideas as upon the shores of childhood."
Both Dickens and Goethe have left vivid descriptions of the Basilica of St. Peter's when lit up at night. Let's join Dickens again on that same Easter day.
When the night came on, without a cloud to dim the full moon, what a sight it was to see the great square full once more, and the whole church from the cross to the ground, lighted with innumerable lanterns, tracing out the architecture and winking and shining all round the colonnade of the piazza. And what a sense of exultation, joy, delight it was when the great bell struck 7:30, on the instant, to behold one bright red mass of fire soar gallantly from the top of the cupola to the extremest summit of the cross, and the moment it leapt into its place become the signal of a bursting out of countless lights, as great and red and blazing as itself, from every part of the gigantic church, so that every cornice, capital, and smallest ornament of stone expressed itself in fire, and the black, solid groundwork of the enormous dome seemed to glow transparent as an eggshell. And 2 hours afterwards, when we'd got away and gone upon a distant height and looked towards it, there it still stood, shining and glittering in the calm night like a jewel, not a line of its proportions wanting, not an angle blunted, not a tome of its radiance lost.
Goethe witnessed the lighting up of the dome on the feast of Saints Peter and Paul.
The sky was pure and calm. The moon shone sweetly and poured what was like a luminous vapor onto the flames of the lamps. But at the end, when all became fire, the splendor of the moon was dimmed. It is only when we think that this enormous building at that moment serves only as a framework that we realize that nothing quite like it can be seen anywhere in the world.
Jill Bevilacqua's program from her series, And They Came to Rome.